1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 1. This is a faithful saying. If a man desires the position of a bishop, he desires a good work. A bishop, then, must be blameless, the husband of one wife, temperate, sober-minded, of good behavior, hospitable, able to teach, not given to wine, not violent, not greedy for money, but gentle, not quarrelsome, not covetous, one who rules his own house well, having his children in submission with all reverence. For if a man does not know how to rule his own house, how will he take care of the church of God? Not a novice, lest being puffed up with pride, he fall into the same condemnation as the devil. Moreover, he must have a good testimony among those who are outside, lest he fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. Paul begins the passage in the third chapter of his first letter to Timothy with the words, "This is a faithful saying." Surely, anything in the Bible is faithful. Why does Paul indicate that what is about to follow is a faithful saying? Does that mean anything he gives us which isn't preceded by the words, "This is a faithful saying," is not faithful? No. Evidently, the part that follows was a well-known saying within the early church. Timothy is doubtless already familiar with it, but Paul is endorsing it. This is a faithful saying. If a man desires the position of a bishop, he desires a good work. Now, straight away, the word bishop stands out. If you're reading the Authorized Version or the New King James, if you're using another version, it might say overseer, it might say pastor. And the word is presbyter. It can mean overseer, it can mean pastor, it can mean elder, it can mean bishop. We did a study of these words in our Bible study a couple of years ago, and we concluded quite rightly, I think, that they can be used interchangeably. So the version from which I preach uses the word bishop. It might be yours say something different. When I think of the word bishop, I think of somebody in the Church of England or the Catholic Church wearing cloth of gold and a mitre. That image may or may not be helpful. There is a little bit of politics in the choice of the word, certainly in the Authorised Version. King James I, who commissioned it, was very keen that he retains bishops in the Church of England and that they don't move to a Presbyterian model like they had in Scotland, from where, of course, he came. To quote King James, "No bishops, no king." And funnily enough, when Parliament later on that century got rid of bishops, they also got rid of the king. However, I don't think we need concern ourselves with 17th century history. The important thing I'd say here is that a bishop is a pastor, it is an elder, it's somebody within the church who has a spiritual responsibility for both pastoral care and for teaching. Now, next Sunday morning, God willing, we'll be looking at the qualifications for deacons. So, now we've cleared up the word bishop, we could read it, therefore, if a man desires a position of pastor, of elder, he desires a good work. Is being a pastor something we should desire? I've come across people before who have desired the position, and I've thought, mm-mm-mm. Psalm 37 verse 4 says, "Delight thyself also in the Lord, and he shall give thee the desires of thine heart." As a believer, we're no longer our own. We're free, and yet we've been bought at a price. And the Christian life is one of submission to the will of God. We become servants of God, slaves of God, if you want to use the actual word, which we don't like, but it's there in the Greek. And as a servant of the Master, we do his will, not ours. And the psalm there is saying that when you delight yourself in God, when your joy is found in the Lord, when the focus of your being is within him, and you delight in him, that which your heart desires is that which he wants to give. And so a godly man may well indeed desire the position of pastor, and God in his wisdom may well provide one. As an aside, I'm not entirely sure why anybody would want the job unless God really has called them to do it. I said this morning that being a Christian, becoming a Christian, does not take away life's problems, it adds to them. Well, if you don't feel you have enough problems in life or in the church, desire the position of pastor, because it comes with problems free of charge. I put it to you that those wishing to do it for right reasons are probably called by God and are therefore desiring a good thing. Paul then goes on to list the qualifications of what a pastor ought to have. And some of them are straightforward and some of them will require a little bit of thought. Verse 2, a bishop then must be blameless. It literally means not held on a charge. If ever you're arrested, you'll be taken to a station, and at the station, that is the time when the state will charge you. You are accused of doing such a thing before you'll be taken to court, where you'll be asked to enter a plea. So the bishop then must be blameless, not on a charge, either by the world or by the congregation. Again, Daniel has been much on my mind. Daniel chapter 6 and verse 5. Then these men said, we shall not find any charge against this Daniel, unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God. Oh, how they must have gone through Daniel's possessions and his bank accounts and his dealings with the various people in the Persian province of Babylonia, looking for corruption, looking for a whiff of scandal, looking for a bit of wink, wink, nudge, nudge, but they found nothing. And so when they decided to lay charges against Daniel, to bring him down, to have him thrown into that lion's den, they knew it would have to be with his faith in God. That, from their point of view, was his major weakness. We know that was his strength, the source of his strength. So a church leader must be without blame. The husband of one wife. Now, what does that mean? It literally means a one-woman man. A one-woman man. So some people think that refers to polygamy. Polygamy, having several multiple wives, actually wasn't a major feature of the Greek or Roman world. So it might have been, and certainly there are characters in the Old Testament who had more than one wife. So it's possibly a reference to that. Is it referring to somebody who hasn't been divorced? Possibly. But again, it doesn't really mention marriage per se. Is it talking of widowers? People who have married but their partner is deceased? Possibly, but I think that's unlikely. Is it referring to single people? We all know, I'm sure, well, I certainly believe it, that many pastors are well supported by their wives. Their wives become almost their main support, part of that ministry. I don't necessarily think, though, Paul is saying that. In 1 Corinthians 7, verse 8, he indicates that he himself is single and therefore he'd be excluding himself from such ministry. I suspect it's referring simply to adultery in general. A one-woman man. He's one who marries a wife and loves her and is faithful to her. Because he's a blameless man. We're told he is to be temperate, sober-minded, and of good behavior. Somebody who is not given to drink, I think, is indicated here. Now, in this chapel 100, 150 years ago, temperance would have been preached a great deal. It doesn't really occur in Christianity until the 1800s, and the teetotal movement actually began in Preston, where the term was coined. And the nonconformist churches really ran something of a moral crusade against the demon drink. Gypsy Smith, a great preacher, called it the devil in solution. And temperance bands went about discouraging people from drinking. And once upon a time, this chapel would really have despised the pub over in the village, would have seen it as a rival centre of attraction. In fact, it's now closed down, and I regret that very much. It was a hub of community life, but times change. What Paul is not saying here is that a minister, a pastor, has to be teetotal. I don't drink, and I find that helpful, but I don't think this passage is advocating that. I discovered this week in court that there are several, in fact, crimes to do with being drunk. I've heard of drunk and disorderly. That means you've drunk too much alcohol and you're causing a disturbance and grief. I came across another crime with which somebody had been charged, drunk and incapable. There are no guidelines for it. No one really uses it anymore, except in Blackburn. What does that say? So I looked it up. And it is, in fact, a real law, the Licensing Act 1872, and I quote, "Every person found drunk in any highway or other public place, whether a building or not, or in any licensed premises, shall be liable to a penalty not exceeding 40 shillings. There you go. In other words, it's possible to break the law of this country by being drunk and simply laying across the road. I don't think anyone in here is particularly prone to that temptation. What has that got to do with our text? Well, when people get drunk, they often become disorderly and violent and thuggish. Some people don't. I know some people who are actually slightly more pleasant when they've been drinking. But the problem with being drunk is that you're incapable. You may not be disorderly, but you're incapable. And the man of God, the man who sets his heart on a good work, on the position of a pastor, need not be a total abstainer of alcohol, but neither must he allow it to make him disorderly, and neither must he allow it to make him incapable. He is to be sober-minded. He is to be temperate, of good behaviour. Literally, I think that means to be orderly. He is to be hospitable. Hebrews talks about welcoming strangers. And presumably, this pastor here, this perfect pastor, which I'd love to be, welcomes members of his own congregation. I do that once per year. He gets it all done within one fell swoop. I do believe hospitality is a gift I have yet to receive. But here is the perfect pastor being described. He is to be able to teach. Now, this is the only reference, I think, in this particular text to a gifting or ability as opposed to a trait of character. One who is able to teach. And this, of course, sets him apart from the deacons who will be considered next week. Notice, though, how this comes both after and within the moral standards required of a pastor. It's not good enough for a pastor to have the gift of the gab, to deliver a good sermon, to have a good understanding of the text. It needs to be backed up with lifestyle. Now, this is a challenging word. It really is, for me in particular. There are many out there who are willing and even able to teach. But are they temperate and sober-minded? Are they of good character, good behavior? Are they blameless? In verse 3, not given to wine. Now, I think Paul has made this point already in verse 2 when he talks about being temperate. Perhaps being given to wine was seen as a particular problem back then. Maybe it's a particular problem now as well. I do wonder if our Victorian forebears weren't entirely wrong to focus on the damage that drink can do if taken in excess and without temperance. We're told he's to be not violent. I attended a training course to do with work a few years ago, during which I was told that saying words is a form of violence, and I said, no, it's not. Words can be harmful and they can be damaging. And the scars they lead can often outlive a physical wound which can heal. But I think when Paul says here, not violent, he's actually talking about violence. And there was more violence then than there is now. Certainly, perhaps within a home, within a household, within a church, I don't know. But this bishop, this pastor, this elder, this overseer is not to be a violent man. Nor greedy for money. Remember, money is a currency of wealth which is passing away. In heaven, it's worthless. So any pastor, or indeed any Christian, who's greedy for money, that is a symptom of him being worldly, obsessed with this world, amassing that which cannot go with us. And I think greed for money is a particular problem of the American church. But like most things American, there are paler imitations of it in our own country, in our own churches. Leroy Thompson said, God said, it is time to tell the money, you don't belong to the wicked, you belong to us. Money, come to me now. Copeland, Kenneth Copeland said, I am a billionaire. Because the assignment that the Lord gave me, he said, I want you to begin to confess the billion flow. What does that mean? Well, what it means is that as a man of faith, you confess, you command, you demand that $1 billion to come your way, and God will send it. These people are greedy for money. In fact, they're worse than that, because they fleece the people of God. The money that comes to them is from poorer people who go to their churches and watch their TV shows. Now, of course, it's easy to look at these crackpots in America, of whom there are many. But on a smaller scale, I too, must make sure that I'm not being greedy for money in my own little way. And here is a contrast, but gentle. Why does Paul contrast greed for money with being gentle? Well, maybe he's thinking of the phrase not violent. But there's a sense in which, for Paul, violence and greed for money are somehow linked together, and he contrasts that with being gentle. Maybe he's thinking of sharper business practice here. I don't know. But gentle. Not quarrelsome. Not covetous. Again, is Paul repeating himself? Surely not covetous means not greedy for money. Well, I think he's really, really emphasizing the point here. On two occasions, I think he refers to overconsumption of wine. I think on two occasions, he also refers to unnecessarily desiring money. Now, don't misunderstand me. The people of God ought to be careful with money. It's a worldly saying, but money makes a good servant. A bad master, but a good servant. And money is given to us by the Lord that we might use it for his glory and for others' betterment. But coveting, longing for that which isn't his. This man of God should not covet. And of course it's a reference to the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. And then in verse 4, we come to another fairly difficult bit. Yeah, don't covet, don't drink too much, we get that. But what about this one? One who rules his own house well. How does one rule one's own house well? Well, I think it's referring to the household. It could refer to a house, keeping it nice and tidy and that kind of thing. I don't think that is Paul's main problem. Rule, I think, here means to have authority over. This man, this perfect pastor, which Paul is seeing and describing to Timothy, is to have authority over his family, perhaps the servants who live in his household, if he has any, and is to have that authority over them well. Having his children in submission with all reverence. So must this man have believing children? You see, I know pastors whose children do not walk with the Lord. I know pastors whose children are well away from it. I also know pastors whose children do come to church but don't believe any of it. Should they all resign? Step down after all? Well, let's look at what the children ought to be. They ought to be in submission with all reverence. I've said it before, but I do believe in election. Should a man be barred from ministry because his daughter is not elected by God? Clearly not. I believe it's possible for unbelieving children to be submissive to their parents, by which I mean respectful, and reverential. I think that means respecting their parents' faith and their parents' God. You can revere something. You can revere God without submitting to him. Indeed, without having that saving faith. So I put it to you that this pastor which Paul is describing here manages his own household well. His children, ideally, do believe. That is the greatest expression of respect and reverence, to take on your own father's faith. But if at least there is a respect for their parent and a respect for his faith, I believe that meets the criteria here listed. And then Paul describes a little more in verse 5. For if a man does not know how to rule his own house, how will he take care of the church of God? Now in Matthew chapter 13 and verse 12, the Lord says, for to the one who has, more will be given, and he will have an abundance, but from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. Now the context there is a parable, I appreciate that. But I put it to you that when it comes to Christian ministry, we ought to be doing the little things right before we're trusted with the big things. If a man is not able to bring up his own children, showing them the difference between right and wrong, how can he do that with other people's children, the children of God? If his children despise him, maybe he cannot then take care of the church of God. Notice in verse 5 how Paul links together the word rule and the word care. For if a man does not know how to rule his own house, how will he take care of the church of God? Ruling in the Christian church is not telling other people what to do. It's not making them submit to your authority. It's not showing them who's boss. It's about caring. Caring and ruling in the context of church leadership mean the same thing. In verse 6, we're told he is not to be a novice. By that, a young believer. Young believers, and by that I mean those who have been converted recently, not necessarily people who are physically young, are to be encouraged to serve. Now, I want to be in a church in which everybody has the opportunity to minister and serve in some way. And that might be up front, or it might be cleaning toilets, because we do it to the Lord. And whether you've been converted a long time or a short time, I encourage you to serve. But not necessarily in leadership. And Paul gives the reason. Let's first of all notice what the reason is not. It's not because it offends the pride of those who have been converted longer. Well, I've been in this church 10 years and I've not done that. He's been here 3 years. It's not for that person's benefit. The reason given is lest being puffed up with pride. In other words, it is for the sake of that young believer's own soul that you don't put him in a position of responsibility that puffs him up with pride, makes himself feel better about himself than he ought to feel. No. A pastor needs to be tested to ensure they are indeed called by God and that their conversions are genuine, that they have grown in grace, that they have a track record. I do believe that when people are called to Christian ministry, they already have a track record of doing the things to which they are called. Here's another thought. A pastor, an elder, a minister, in many respects, we're already doing that in our own homes. One who is called to be a pastor should already be fulfilling to some degree that pastoral position, so that when he's asked by the church to take it on, he's simply doing more of what he's already done. Now, what happens to a young novice who has been puffed up with pride? He falls into the same condemnation as the devil. Wow, that's hard. You know, Paul might have said, lest being puffed up with pride, he has a bit of a fall. Lest being puffed up with pride, he annoys other people. Lest being puffed up with... No. He talks about devil and he talks about condemnation. That's strong, isn't it? Well, let's look at passages which are, or a passage which is said to refer to the fall of the devil from the 14th of Isaiah. How you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning. How you are cut down to the ground, you who weakened the nations. For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit on the mount of the congregation, on the farther sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. There's a lot of personal pronoun there, isn't there? I will do this, I will do that, I will do the following. Could it be that a young man puffed up with pride within a church, I will do this, I will do that, I will do that, I will, is imitating somehow Lucifer, however many eons ago? Isaiah chapter 14 continues in verse 15, yet you shall be brought down to Sheol, to the lowest depths of the pit. In other words, we don't invite young believers to positions of authority for the sake of their own soul. The devil fell because of pride, and we must make sure that those in our congregations do not fall in like manner. And finally, in verse 7, moreover, he must have a good testimony among those who are outside, lest he fall into the reproach and the snare of the devil. Unbelievers may well object to his theology, but they cannot object to his lifestyle. Peter says in his first epistle, the second chapter and the 12th verse thereof, live such lives among the pagans that, though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. And yet we have a second reference to the devil in as many verses. Why? I thought we were talking about becoming a pastor, but Paul keeps talking about the devil. Well, those in ministry are of particular interest to the devil. Imagine an old-fashioned set-piece battle. And you've got the enemy soldiers, several lines of them, marching towards you, firing their guns, and you've got a captain behind them urging them on. I tell you, who do you shoot down? You go for the captain. Strike the shepherd, and the sheep will scatter. And therefore, says Paul in verse 7, not only must a pastor be respected, albeit begrudgingly, by those outside, but he needs to be on his guard. Oh, does he need to be on his guard, lest he fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. Well, we've had before, in verse 6, Satan's condemnation, which will happen at the end of time. That's a future event when the devil will be dealt with by Christ once and for all. But the snare of the devil is something we might encounter here and now. The devil lays a snare, a trap, but his condemnation is coming. Yes, he might be condemned, but watch out, because his snares are many and they're near your feet. And they're near my feet. The snare of the devil is for all who, because of pride, become puffed up. And if you're a deacon or an elder or a bishop or a this or a that or the other, beware of pride. If you're the toilet cleaner, you might take pride in your work, but maybe you're less susceptible to pride. Of course, the alternative is to do nothing in the church of God. Oh, I'm a nothing, I'm a nobody, I contribute nothing. Well, I don't think that's the answer either. James offers the remedy to those who are coming close to the devil's snare. James 4, verse 7, submit yourselves therefore to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Resisting the devil is not achieved by going on prayer marches. It's not achieved by claiming Pendle Hill for Jesus. achieved by submitting to God in the small things as well as the big things, at home as well as at church. You show me a church that submits to the will of God. You show me a Christian who submits to God, and I'll show you a devil with a tail between his legs fleeing.